Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Zdenka Sokolichkova, author of The Paradox of Svalbard, Climate Change and Globalization in the Arctic, published this year by Pluto Books. Dr. Sokolichkova, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
To start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
I work as a social anthropologist, and in 2019, I started as a guest researcher at the Department of Social Anthropology at the University of Oslo with a grant that I got to research overheating in the northernmost community in the world, which is Longyearbyen, a small settlement that is located in the high Arctic at the archipelago of Svalbard or Spitsbergen. And this was a 2 years long project that was based on ethnographic fieldwork. So I was living there in the town with my husband and three kids. And I was interested in how people live with accelerated change. So the theme was a place that is changing very fast when it comes to natural environment, when it comes to society and economy. And that was actually the biggest individual research project that I've ever had. So it very much boosted my, I would say, professional career. And I got to learn a lot. And also this monograph is actually the first monumental text based on ethnography that I've ever written. So it has been quite an exciting and also challenging venture, obviously. But thanks to this project and the work that I've done in Svalbard, I also got a new post, which is I work now as a postdoc at the Arctic Center in the Netherlands at the University of Groningen. Though I'm a digital nomad, so I work for them remotely, and I am based in the Czech Republic. And the current project that I've been employed at is about environmental memory of still the same place, the same site, which is Svalbard. And we're interested in how and whether at all there is some compatibility between long-term environmental monitoring and other non-scientific ways of remembering how a landscape or environment has changed. So that's quite an unwalked route. It's an interdisciplinary project, so I still have the approach of doing qualitative research based on ethnography, but I collaborate also with natural scientists and people with different disciplines. And I'm currently on maternity leave because I have just given birth to our fourth kid. So I'm taking a short break, and in April, I'm supposed to continue again as a postdoc at the Arctic Center at the University of Groningen, and this time working on a project that is looking into sustainability of Antarctic tourism. So I'm staying with the polar trouble, but I'm just heading south.
Okay. Congratulations on the new addition to your family there.
Thank you.
Okay. So one of the things that I thought was sort of interesting in how it tied together a lot of the themes of the book is the difficulty of finding affordable housing in Svalbard. So what are some of the factors behind this housing crunch?
Okay, so this housing crisis that has actually lasted for, if not decades, then many years already, is actually grounded in the history of the settlement, which was founded in 1906. By an American businessman, John Munro Longyear. That's also why it's called Longyearbyen. Byen in Norwegian means town. And that was a mining settlement, right? The only purpose of the settlement that high in the Arctic was to have a base from which you can mine this high-quality black coal that is very easily accessible, geologically, I mean, but logistically, it's pretty difficult, obviously. But so this was a company town, as they call it, which means that it's a place that at the beginning was not at all for families. It was only for the miners and some of the people that were running the company. And that meant that everybody who moved there because they had a job in the mine. And so also the mining company was providing housing for all of their employees, which is pretty logical. I mean, it makes sense. But then it developed further, and around the 60s, 70s, when it already was a Norwegian company town, because Norway bought it from the Americans 10 years after it was founded, so since 1916 it's Norwegian, they decided to change a little bit the policy and allowed for families to join the miners living there. So the settlement changed in the sense that suddenly there were more women, more kids. And that also changed the needs of people when it comes to housing, because you cannot be sharing a room with other eight comrades when you're also having your family there with you. So then it still was a company town when people were getting their places through the employer, but the needs were slightly different. And then in the 1990s, I would say that was kind of the rupture in town, in time, when coal mining stopped being the industry of the future for various reasons. Perhaps we are going to talk about that later in the podcast. In every case, Svalbard in general and Longyearbyen opened up to the world, and new industries or new economies came up, also supported by the Norwegian government, which was mostly tourism and research and education. And that, I mean, it opened up to commercial enterprises, to people from the outside. And suddenly there were people going to Svalbard to settle down without having an employer that could provide them with a flat or a house to live in. So people started, I mean, private persons started to buy housing units and then rent them out commercially. And tourism attracted, I mean, small companies started to mushroom, big companies, also multinationals started to arrive, because it's obviously quite quite convenient financially to develop tourism at such a unique and attractive destination. And also all the scientists from all around the world started to come, because the university center was opened in the 1993, I think, and grew quite fast. So then suddenly, within about a decade, you have a place that used to be a very easily legible structure, company town with everyone knowing everyone and everyone being employed at the same place, to a cosmopolitan, very international place full of people from all around the world that were having all sorts of jobs, and only some of the employers were having housing units at their disposal to provide their employees with them. So then this created the very tough housing crisis that has been experienced already, I think, at the turn of the millennium. But I mean, I came there in 2019. It was critical and got horrendous during the COVID crisis. And I hear, I'm following still the developments. It's not getting better. And the reason is that the state still doesn't want to change this policy that was there from the very beginning, which is when you go to Svalbard or to Longyearbyen, go there when you have a stable job and you have an employer who can provide you with a place to stay. But people just don't do that, right? Today, the world is very different to what it was in the second half of the 20th century. So people come even without having a job, for example, because they hear or they learn online that Svalbard is the only place where you can go without a visa. It's out of Schengen. You don't need a work permit, which is again related to the Svalbard Treaty, which probably will need to be mentioned in the podcast so that our listeners can understand the legal framework that is underpinning how life is in Svalbard. And anyway, it's a place that seems quite utopian from the outside, because it's open to everyone. But then that means that you can have people coming there without having a job, without having a place to stay. And then they're trying to accommodate their needs on the private market, which is accelerating the speed of prices that are rising. And it also means that people accept conditions that are actually either directly illegal or they're definitely not comfortable, especially when it comes to families. And also tourism, I think, contributes to this housing crisis quite a lot. It's mostly seasonal. You can imagine this high in the Arctic, there is a lot of darkness in the winter. So for 4 months, it's actually dark. So there is not much going on in tourism. And that means that the busy period starts in February and ends, let's say, August, September. So that's the period when the town is full of people who are trying to surf this booming industry. That means guides, nature guides. That means people who work in tourism, in catering, in hotel accommodation services. You know, there are loads of jobs that suddenly pop up when tourists start coming. And also these seasonal workers urgently need accommodation, and they kind of contribute to this tension when it comes to housing. So this has been a known problem for a long time. But since the state, the Norwegian state, doesn't want to, adapt to this new reality, and they're quite stubborn on the principle of let's have the people provide themselves with housing through their employers, because then they can control who these employers are, mostly either Norwegian state owned or co-owned or co-controlled companies. It's easier to have an overview of the population. But I mean, people don't obey what nation states wish. So there's a mess in town, simply said, because you have a lot of people in need of housing, and it's not going to be solved. It might seem as an easy political task to tackle, but it's not. It's actually catch 22 in a way, because the government wants new industries and new economies, but it doesn't want opening up and accommodating the needs of these new people that have to take up the jobs that are appearing with the new economies.
Yeah, and then it sounds like environmental change is part of the picture too, because there've been some housing that's been either damaged by landslides or like preemptively shut down out of concern for those kinds of things. Is that right?
That's very true. Yeah. So people normally, if they have heard about Svalbard before, they probably have heard about it being the hotspot of the climate crisis and global warming. Because indeed, because of the Arctic amplification, these Arctic places are warming up much faster than other parts of the planet. This is also obviously true for Longyearbyen. And so you have, you know, all these typical symptoms of the climate crisis, like temperatures that are increasing, awkward extreme weather events, that you can have downpour in the winter, that you can have lots of snow that are coming at awkward times of the year, or strange winds, that you have sea ice that is diminishing or not even appearing at all during a season. So we're soon having a North Pole that will be ice-free, glaciers that are drastically retreating, that you can even notice from 1 year to another. So all these typical things are very visible also in Longyearbyen. And as one of my colleagues, a social anthropologist, Alexandra Meyer, has written in her paper, that there has been an avalanche in December 2015, which gave climate change a face in Longyearbyen, in the sense that before, climate change as a term was still rather an abstract concept. But when the avalanche hit shortly before Christmas and destroyed 11 houses and also killed two people, one of them was a two-year-old girl, it was a shock, like a great rupture in the collective memory of the community. And people suddenly started to think about climate change in relation to this avalanche, which was, directly endangering their lives while thinking being safe at home. So because of this avalanche, as I also write in the book and develop further in another paper that I've been writing together with Alex Meyer already mentioned, this avalanche has been also used as a token, kind of, of climate change and to push an agenda that is related to the housing crisis that we've been talking about before, which is that this area under the mountain from which the avalanche came has been kind of indicated or identified as a risk zone. And that meant that I think over 160 housing units have been demolished, and they were partly replaced, but those housing units were more open for people to rent from all the different economic sectors that exist in town, while the new housing units that have been built since are only available for state employees. So that means that it has tightened even the lack of housing, or made it worse, because these housing units were demolished due to the risk of an avalanche. In addition, there has been there have been avalanche fences built on the mountain of Suketopen. So if you go to Longyearbyen, you immediately see, the visual impact on the town has also been dramatic, and other avalanche protection measures. So the topic of climate change in relation to these hazards or risks has been very prominent since 2015, and indeed worsened the housing crisis.
Okay, so you mentioned the Svalbard Treaty in the course of that last answer. So let's kind of go back and fill that in for the listeners. So what is the legal status of Svalbard and its political relationship with Norway?
I'll start from the deeper past. So for many long centuries, Svalbard was actually considered terra nullius, meaning no man's land. It didn't really belong to any country, any nation state. The first person who is historically recorded to have observed, let's not say discovered, Spitsbergen, as it was called by then, was a Dutch seaman Willem Barents, and Spitsbergen means a pointy mountain. That's what many of the mountains in Svalbard look like, and that was at the end of the 16th century. And since then, there were many countries that were interested in the natural resources that were available. In the beginning, obviously, it was industries such as whaling, perhaps, was the most monstrous one. There were many countries, Englishmen, Dutchmen, Swedes, Scandinavians in general, that participated in the whaling industry and pretty much deplenished, killed all the whales quite fast that were available by then. And then, hunting, sealing, and the deposits of the coal were discovered at the end of the 19th century. And that's when coal mining became one of the main interests for many countries. And again, Americans were also in the play. And suddenly Svalbard, which was no man's land, became a place of potential conflict in the future because there were many resources available and it belonged to nobody. So then countries tried to figure this out, how to solve the problem. But then the World War I came. And after the First World War, Norway, which was a relatively fresh, young, independent country, rather poor, but dynamic and ambitious, managed to draft this document that was quite unprecedented, I think, in international law, that was called Svalbard Treaty, or Spitsbergen Treaty in the beginning. So it was signed in 1920. And entered into force in 1925. And since then, Svalbard actually belongs to the Kingdom of Norway. It's part of the Kingdom of Norway. But the Svalbard Treaty is very specific in how it delineates Norway's sovereignty. So it's an absolute sovereignty that Norway has over the territory, but there are conditions, which are that Norway has to govern the territory in a way that is in line with what all the signatory parties have agreed upon. Until today, I think it's 44 countries that have signed Svalbard Treaty, and I think Turkey has applied recently, and it's open for any other country to join later. And so the nationals of all the signatory parties have to have free access to the territory. So you have to be allowed to go there That's why there is no visa requirement. That's also why many Norwegian laws that are valid on Norwegian mainland cannot be valid in Svalbard. For example, the immigration law or the social security law and many others that are quite relevant also for my work. So it's this open territory where anybody from the signatory parties is welcome. Plus, Norway is also obliged to protect the natural environment that is considered vulnerable, and it should not the place should not be used for military purposes. And there are some more clauses. It was written in 1920, so it's a lot about mining. And yeah, a very important point that I haven't mentioned yet is that the whole point about the Svalbard Treaty is that since there are all these very rich natural resources, countries that sign the treaty, their nationals and the companies should have equal access, equal conditions, like Norwegians, to gain these natural resources. So it was a lot about mining. Tourism and science were not a thing in 1920, so they're not really explained how Norway should go about this, and that's also where there are many misunderstandings and perhaps conflicts of interpretation. But the purpose is that people can come freely from the signatory parties, and they can engage in economic activities using the natural resources available. So this document celebrated 100 years in 2020, and it's likely that it will last, but obviously there have always been a few countries that have been challenging the way Norway is governing the territory, and they're claiming that it's in conflict with what Svalbard Treaty delineates, and that's probably not very surprisingly Russia and recently also China. So these are very ambitious countries that have their plans in the Arctic, and they're trying to challenge Norwegian sovereignty over the territory, while the rest of the countries have until now seen the Norwegian sovereignty as absolute and also legitimate. You might have heard about a conflict with the European Union. I'm not an expert on marine law, so I would not delve too much into it, but there's an issue about snow crab, which is a new species that is arriving to the Arctic with the global warming, because it's thriving in the warmer waters. And there has been a conflict between European Union and Norway, how far from the coast of Svalbard Norway is entitled to decide on rules on who will harvest the resources, because the European Union would claim it's a shorter distance, while Norway claims it's much, much longer, 200 nautical miles, I think. This is the situation today. No word has ever been changed in Svalbard Treaty, which is also a pretty short document. And as said, it's unprecedented in the international law. Very interesting document. And that's also what makes the place so special and unique and intriguing, both for people to live there and for social scientists to study it.
Okay. I want to now pick up on this economic change that we're talking about, going from, you know, coal mining, which everybody understands is a very extractive kind of industry, towards tourism and science, which you're arguing are extractive in their own way, even though they have a much more kind of green reputation, that there's an extractive dimension to tourism and science in Svalbard. So could you elaborate on that point?
Yeah, I'm trying to argue that it might seem like a black and white story, that you have coal mining, which is dirty, burning coal certainly contributes to the climate change. So that's the bad thing, kind of in this black and white picture. And then you have the good thing, which is tourism, meaning that people go to these places and they see how they're melting away, and they will become more conscious about the danger of climate change and perhaps change their behavior. And science also seems to be an environmental neutral or even positive economy. But what I'm trying to argue in the book, what I've seen in the ethnography, is that there is a sort of a kinship between these industries. Obviously, there is something very physical and very brutal about coal mining, meaning that you penetrate the mountains and you take out this substance and then you burn it. So this extractivism is kind of very, very visible and obvious. But I argue that tourism and science or development, you know, development of green technologies can be extractive in a softer way, but there still is this red thread of doing things for the purpose of a profit and taking something out of the environment without giving anything back to it. And I think that is something that, that is very typical for Longyearbyen slash Svalbard. So I think it's easier to see it in tourism because when it comes to, for example, the ecological footprint of, let's speak about conventional cruises, for example, because cruise tourism has been booming perhaps the fastest in Svalbard and also in generally in Arctic and also in the Antarctic, probably globally, that the footprint of this concrete face of the industry is immense. All the people that are living on these huge luxurious ships and the level of consumerism and also the way of how you actually consume the place, right? It's not that you're learning, that you're opening up your horizons or that you're going through a transformative experience. It's just one more thing on your bucket list, and spending little time frenetically moving on the sea routes to visit all these places and take the selfies and kind of, you know, then these people are actually mining memories, mining images, mining experiences. So it's a softer extractivism, but there still is the extractive aspect of it also when you look at, for example, the living and working conditions of people that are employed by the industry. People are usually quite surprised to hear that the biggest ethnic minorities or national minorities in Svalbard are people from Thailand and the Philippines. So these are people going there because tourism generates a lot of jobs that are not attractive to Europeans or Americans. And they are also more eager to accept working conditions that perhaps Europeans or Americans would decline because they can still earn relatively good money there and they can send remittances back home and perhaps support their loved ones. So it still makes sense to them to take up these jobs and maybe suffer also in this cold climate when you come from a tropical country. It's not easy. In addition with this housing crisis, in addition with Norwegian laws that are not valid, so there's very little protection when it comes to these workers that work in precarious jobs. So how did I get here?
We were talking about the Svalbard Treaty and, you know, the status that gives this territory
I was talking about the extractive aspect of tourism. So that's these workers in the precarious jobs or the guides who have also very often unregulated working hours and living conditions that are quite scandalous. They also suffer from this extractivist aspect of tourism. And I think, yeah, the ecological footprint of tourism has been becoming more obvious and more discussed. And I also think that the industry is aware, so they're trying to tackle this issue and become more sustainable, become greener. And for example, in the case of Svalbard, I think conventional cruise ships will disappear soon because Norway is changing the laws and they're, for example, banning heavy fuel that is used by many of these huge ships. So those won't be probably returning to the place. But so it's I'm arguing about this more abstract or philosophical aspect of the industries, showing that the extractivist point of view is still there, it's still present. So it's not really black and white. There are many colors and many shades that are it's useful to be critical about this black and white story about coal mining being bad and tourism and science being good, also because of the local source of energy, right? So coal is the only thing that is actually locally available. All the other stuff has to be imported. And then how do you count the ecological footprint? What comes in the calculation when you have to, for example, import diesel or whatever the future energy source will become for Longyearbyen, because coal mining is going to be phased out for sure within a couple of years.
Yeah, so circling around to the climate change issue, so a lot of the book is hearing from people in Svalbard of their perspective on climate change. And it seems like a frequent theme there is people saying, well, yeah, climate change is a thing, but there's all this other stuff going on too. Whereas, you know, outsiders might just see Svalbard as part of this big global story about climate change, but the people living on Svalbard see a lot of other things, you know, playing into the things that outsiders might point to as like, yep, that's part of the climate change story. That's part of the climate change story.
Exactly. Yeah, that was also in. Partly, it was also the image that I was having in my mind when I was going as an ethnographer to Longyearbyen. It was this big, rather monothematic story of climate change. But then when I started to talk to people, I noticed exactly this, what you point out, that people are busy thinking about many other things than climate change. And they also, when you ask them about developments, when it comes to life in the town in the recent years, they don't see a point in dividing the story of environmental change and economic change and social change. They see it, they live it as an entangled thing. And that was what intrigued me. And I think it makes sense to look at these processes as linked, because indeed they are. I mean, tourism, but you can look at the economic effect of tourism, but you cannot avoid the ecological impact, neither the social one. So it makes sense to look at it through the eyes of my research participants, because they see them as connected. And for some of them, environmental change is indeed the most worrisome. So you have some groups in town that do have a lot to say and also personally relate to and be concerned, young people, activists, but climate scientists, there are many natural scientists, and normally these are young, highly educated, and they know, they see what's going on, and their work proves it. So they're very busy thinking about climate change. But then you have other groups in town, for example, the miners or retired miners or people who have relatives that have been connected to the mining company, and they obviously have a very, very different take on climate change. They try to relativize it because it's a coping strategy for them, because it's very difficult to acknowledge that your whole life story is actually connected to something that has been doing a bad thing to the global climate, or that is worsening living conditions for people on the other part side of the planet. So I can totally understand why they're reluctant to play this climate change card. But they also have a point in showing, but look at social inequalities, look at the segregation that has been going on since this town has become so cosmopolitan and super diverse. Because listen, this is a place very tiny, it's a village actually, 2,500 people, but more than 50 nationalities, and you have people of all sorts, really, from analphabets to highly educated single people, young, elderly. There are not too many, but there still is a handful, very many families with small kids, with grown-up kids. It's very, very diverse. Also within the national minorities, also within the Thai and the Filipino group, it's not true that these are low-skilled people, not at all. It's just that, for example, their diplomas are not being acknowledged. So that's why an interior designer has to accept a job serving breakfast in a hotel. So it's an extremely diverse and very thrilling for an ethnographer community to study. But these different groups have different foci, I would say. They notice different stuff. And these are all processes that are going parallel, hand in hand, or some of them trigger other process is. So I was interested in listening to all these stories that are sometimes very complex and messy, and you tend to snarl up in those because it's difficult to find out, okay, what is the red thread, what is the story that I can narrate in the book so that it makes sense, it's not just a mess of all sorts of processes going on. But I think I tried in the book to stick to these three themes, environment, economy, and society or community, and show through different angles and the voices of my research participants what are these stories of change and what they can teach us about climate change and globalization and social inequality and justice in today's world.
Yeah, the thing I found interesting about Svalbard as a place to do this kind of climate ethnography, as compared to, you know, other ones that I've read in other places, is the rapid turnover of the population, because most of the people in Svalbard are not, you know, there their entire life. They're there a much shorter period of time. So how does that affect people's perspectives and the role of memory in understanding climate change and environmental change?
This is quite a tricky question because, obviously the turnover, the fact that people come and go, is quite decisive in many aspects. So the average stay, I think now, is something between 4 and 7 years, but there are some segments of the economy where people come and go even faster, which is, for example, the state bureaucrats, which is quite critical because those are people that are actually locally governing the place, and they're coming and going really fast. So you always have this learning phase, and then you start to understand where you are, and then you leave again. So there is very little continuity, and also loss of knowledge is something that people have been talking about a lot, also in relation to this avalanche that happened. So it is indeed related to the memory of the place when it comes to people who inhabit it. There is a handful of families that have a longer history in Svalbard. I think I mentioned it also in the book that the research participant that I met who had the longest personal history was the fourth generation. His children were the fifth generation living in Svalbard, which is not too long. I mean, it's about 100 years. So it's a very fluid place in the sense that there is a stream of newcomers, which makes it also very accommodating for newcomers because almost everybody has been through the same thing, arriving there as a new person and then getting to know others. So there are also positive sides about the turnover. But yeah, this environmental issue, I think I kind of noticed it during my work because I soon understood I need to talk to people who actually have been living there long, because otherwise I end up having conversations with everyone telling me, yeah, you know, I've been living here for 3 years, so I don't really know. But what I hear from others, or what I hear from those that have been living here long. So that was also one of the motivations for me to learn Norwegian as fast as possible so that I could actually talk to these old timers or veterans. Many of them grumpy old men, many of them former miners, or their families. But there are also some people that have been living there for 20, 30 years that started some tourist tour company. So also people working in tourism that have been living there long. But anyway, to start to talk to people that actually have lived through these environmental changes, those that remember the fjord that is called the Ice Fjord, which used to be covered with ice, which is something that is very, very awkward to imagine for the newcomers, because it hasn't happened for many years already, probably will never happen again. During our lives. So that was an important thing for me to get access to this segment of the population, of the people that have actually seen and lived how the place has warmed up. And again, among them, the level of concern is very varied, which is related to their personal life stories. What is the main kind of theme or main concern of theirs at the moment? And for many of them, it's not the climate. It's rather the economy or the social outlook of the place.
Yeah, so you mentioned learning Norwegian, and that was a thing I noticed as you were talking about your research process in the book, that it sounds like you started out doing most of your interviews in English, but then you found that you could get a different perspective on things by talking to people in Norwegian. So what was the role of that choice of language in doing the research and being able to, you know, connect with people and get their stories and their perspectives.
I think I was a bit naive when I went to Longyearbyen thinking that I can do this in English. But I mean, there wasn't much information about the place in English. There were many writings that were in Norwegian, so inaccessible for me, from which I would have understood that knowing the language is actually still quite important, exactly, for example, because of this fact of those staying long, the vast majority of them being Norwegian. And even though Norwegians or Scandinavians, Finno-Scandinavians usually imagined as speaking fluent English, they do speak good English, but when you ask them about their personal memories, experiences, emotions, it's much, much easier, and it's natural that it's better to do it in your mother tongue. So that's that was my fault, kind of a lack of competence on my side, which I realized quite fast. So I think it did a very good thing for my research, because one, people realize that I'm taking this seriously. I'm taking their story seriously. I want to listen to them. I want to ask a proper question, and I want to understand everything they're telling me. And that's why I have invested a lot of time and energy into learning Norwegian during the first year of my stay. It's a very typical thing in anthropology. That's nothing new and no rocket science, that knowing the vernacular opens up doors, and it's a gate to the community in a way. So and it definitely was also a very important tool, working tool for me when it comes to all sorts of writings, you know, documents, papers from political meetings. Knowing the language made it much, much easier and richer. I think it's you have a very narrow entry point if you come to that place only, I mean, without knowing Norwegian. Obviously, it would have been very handy to know Thai or speak some of the Filipino languages that are spoken in town, but I couldn't manage that within 2 years. So there I had to rely on field assistants and translators. But Norwegian is not a very difficult language when you speak English and German. And yeah, it was worth the pain of learning it. It definitely paid off.
All right. So as we're moving towards the end of our time, I wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were writing this book.
Well, the first thank you would definitely go to Thomas Ylon Eriksen, who is a person who believed in me already in 2016, I think it was, when I sent him an email. He's a social anthropologist living in Norway, pretty well known, I would say, beyond Europe for his work. Also, globalization and climate change has been one of his research topics. As he says, he's a coconut boy, so he has been doing ethnographic research in other parts of the world, definitely not in the cold and dark parts of the planet. But when I contacted him, I knew him briefly since 2015, and I sent him an email saying that I would be up for this research venture, and he believed in me and supported my grant application. And thanks to that, I believe, because he was the mentor of my project, the Marie Sklodowska Curie individual fellowships, that's why I got the money and had the opportunity to do this ethnographic fieldwork. So without him, without his support, his help as a mentor, and also as giving me comments and motivating me to write the book, to finish up this project and disseminate the results of my work, this would not have happened. It would not have existed at all. So I think he's the first person to thank. And then, you know, there are hundreds of people that I've met on my way, my research participants, and a handful of them have also become friends. And I think it would take too long to name them all. So I would just like to say that I realize that nothing can be achieved by yourself. You're all your life, you're dependent on love and empathy of others. And I've seen this very much during the ethnographic fieldwork and while writing the book. And also, obviously, my family, everybody who was very tightly around me, seeing me and experiencing me nervous and not sure whether I'll manage such a task as writing an ethnographic monograph and who still believed I could make it. So all those people around me, I almost feel like this should be a collective monograph, you know, it's not one person who has written it, but it's been thanks to the help of all the others. But this is the world we live in, that we write single authored books, but there are these hundreds of people who help this be born, exist, and develop. And now that the life of the book is after all this has been finished, right? That how it will be received by readers and what kind of questions it will trigger in my audience, that's completely beyond my control. But they also, the readers, the readership is part of the whole story.
Okay. And so then that brings us to our traditional final question on the New Books Network, which is, what are you working on next?
Yeah, as I've mentioned in the intro, I'm quite thrilled to have this new upcoming postdoc position in a project that is called Guide Bast. And that's about Antarctic tourism. So as you know, Arctic tourism has been a thing for quite a while. Antarctic tourism is perhaps younger, but it's booming equally fast. It's very, very attractive. It's kind of the last outpost on planet Earth before you fly to moon, kind of. Very otherworldly environment, very environmentally vulnerable and very fast warming up. So there are many parallels with the Arctic or with Svalbard, but there are also many, many things that are different. And this project that is called Guide Bast, that is funded by the Dutch Research Council, is relatively applied in the sense that we're trying to figure out what sustainable tourism in the Antarctic means, whether anything as polar ambassadorship actually exists, because this ambassadorship is a concept that is being heavily used in the tourism industry as a good thing. And we want to explore what it means, whether it actually exists. And we're focusing on the tour guides. So these are the first-hand kind of mediators of the Antarctic environment when it comes to tourists and how they experience it. So we're going to talk to guides about their motivations to work in the industry, how they see it developing, and what kind of guiding styles they develop, what kind of message they want their guests to go home with, to see whether or what kind of activities, touristic activities in the Antarctic can indeed have either a good positive impact or at least a neutral impact, because we believe that there are many activities going on and growing, or with the potential of growing, that are actually environmentally unsustainable and should not be supported and should be therefore banned by the international community. So the project is again linked to environment, change, sustainability. But I'm looking forward to changing the research side. Obviously, this cannot be long-term fieldwork. I cannot drag a family of six to the Antarctic. There's no place where we could live. But that will be a fieldwork on board of an expedition cruise ship. But it's going to be exciting, and I hope I can build up on the capacities and skills that I've gained during my work in Svalbard.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be looking forward to seeing the results of that. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and enjoy reading the book.
This has been a conversation with Zdenka Sokolichkova, author of The Paradox of Svalbard, Climate Change and Globalization in the Arctic, published this year by Pluto Books.